Reviews and Beyond is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, a state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts have been creating economic opportunity through arts and culture by producing community festival and events, including Arctoberfest, Chico Palio, the True North Tour, the Silent Film Festival, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsofthearts.org. No, Friends of the Arts, upstate.org. And by Satava Art Glass Studio, creating internationally acclaimed art glass in Chico since 1977. You can experience the magic of Satava Art Glass by visiting their gallery at 819 Wall Street, Tuesday through Saturday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Find Satava Art Glass on the web at satava.com. It's 6:01. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the Foothills, and beyond. We're in our spring pledge drive. If you'd like to pledge, call 895-0131. We've got Mary Kay, Jen, and Lori out there to take your calls. 895-0131. Now for Radio Parallax. We switched them up.
Hello and welcome to Butte Views and Beyond. My name is Ray Lager.
Apologize, but if I'm honest, I don't know exactly what I did. Hate how we ended it, and I'm hardly innocent. I swear I gave all I could give. There are times when I wish it wasn't over. But these scars, they prove I don't have what you need. You're just too smart for your own damn good. For your own damn good. This hurts far worse than I thought it would. Than I thought it would. Really do care, but if you gotta know the truth, well, I'm 10% sorry, but I'm 90% sorry for you. So my much I'd like to say, but I guess I'm still afraid of what my words might make you do. 'Cause I've seen your lows and highs, but now I realize it can't be love if I can't speak the truth. There are times when I wish it wasn't over, but these scars, they prove I don't have what you need. You're just too smart for your own damn good.
This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Yes, that's me, Douglas Everett. And it's been a wonderful thing that for the past many years, Radio Parallax has found a home here at KZFR in Chico. A community-based radio station is certainly dependent upon you, the community, my dear listener, to do what you can to contribute financially to its continued success. And success is a good word to use if you look at the wonderful assortment of programming brought to you every hour of every day of the week by 90.1 FM here in Chico. Everyone does a great job, from General Manager Rick Anderson right on down the line. We want to thank people standing by to take your calls, and we hope you will call in and pledge your support.
Support KZFR today by making your pledge at kzfr.org or by calling 530-895-0131.
We've enjoyed so many of our guests over the past many years. It's hard to pick one segment to go with, but I think today we could not go wrong by airing the interview we conducted at his home in Los Angeles with the legendary author Ray Bradbury. We're sure that KZFR is the kind of station Ray Bradbury would support. Sadly, Mr. Bradbury has left us, and I'm further sad to note that the house where this interview was conducted in got bought by somebody else and was later knocked down. But luckily for all of us, his works remain with us, and so does this interview. We're going to take a break in the middle of it, but please, while it's airing, don't hesitate to pick up the phone and make a pledge. One of the great joys of doing a radio program for KDVS is the chance we have to go out and meet really, truly interesting people. People who have made a difference over the years. People who have changed society in some cases. And our guest in this segment is certainly an example of that. The legendary science fiction author, Ray Bradbury. I think it's a good bet that almost anyone listening to this program at the moment has read some of the works of Ray Bradbury, which include Fahrenheit 451, Dandelion Wine, The Martian Chronicles, and Something Wicked This Way Comes. He has numerous short story collections, having written well over 300 short stories, with numerous screenplays and teleplays to his credit as well. If that wasn't enough, Ray Bradbury has numerous published works of poetry. He's written plays. He even wrote the screenplay for the 1956 John Huston film, Moby Dick. Assisting me with this interview is one of Radio Parallax's Los Angeles correspondents, Bruce Bronstein. Mr. Bradbury, thank you so much for inviting us into your home.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
My interest was rekindled in your work when I read an excellent biography of a man you knew slightly, but had a chance to observe back in the 1930s, Jack Parsons.
Oh, sure, of course, yeah.
The author, George Pendle, spoke to you. I guess you corresponded by email about Parsons. And I was privileged to be at the Planet Fest event hosted by the Planetary Society, where they landed the Spirit rover on Mars. You were in attendance, and they did a reading from the Martian Chronicles.
That's correct. They're a wonderful group.
In reading this book about Parsons, and Bruce has talked about Jack Parsons, how they jokingly refer to JPL as Jack Parsons Laboratory back in the 1930s. But it never really struck me till I read this book how literally true it is that those who wrote works of science fiction are responsible for the development of going into space, the Build a Space program.
Oh, yeah. I bumped into a lot of the astronauts over a period of time, and I discovered that they were reading me and H.G. Wells and Jules Verne and Robert Heinlein and two or three others. But I felt so damn proud that I was an influence on these young men. I went down to Texas, and I was at the Space Center there in January of 1967. And Life magazine sent me down to interview all the people and to look at the grounds and see what they were doing. So we had a press meeting with the Life magazine editor there with 70 astronauts, all unknown, no names, you see, because they weren't famous yet.
Right.
They were just people. But I was sitting in the back of the room, and when the Life editor said, and I'm very pleased to tell you that we have with us today, in the back of the room is Ray Bradbury. 60 of the astronauts jumped to their feet and ran back and surrounded me. Can you imagine how I felt? I was embarrassed and I blushed, but oh God, it was beautiful. Then I spent time two or three days later with John Glenn, and he offered to fly me home in his own jet.
Wow.
What an offer, you know? But I'd never flown up at that time. I was afraid of flying. So I turned down John Glenn, and he said, "Well, Ray," he said, "the stagecoach leaves for Tombstone in the morning." And every time I've seen John Glenn since, he looks at me and says, "Tombstone." So, well, I learned to fly later. I'm sorry that I didn't have that chance, a real chance, and took it. I didn't.
It would have been like his own private jet.
Well, it was his own jet, yeah.
Here we were in this room watching, with holding our breath, literally, as they were about to land this robot on Mars. And, of course, at that time, they were commemorating how people had seen things like this from so long ago, and that's where they read from your novel. What was that like for you to be in the room waiting with all of us to see if we were making a landing on Mars?
I always knew it would happen, but it was wonderful to have it actually occur.
And here we are 2 years later, and these dune buggies are still on the surface of Mars wheeling around.
Well, the extra thing about this, out at Universal, they're planning a new version of the Martian Chronicles. They've owned the rights for 8 years. They've got 16 scripts. And I call them every once in a while. I say, "For God's sake, we're going to civilize Mars before you do the damn film." So there are all these delays with the actual Martian landing and with making the film over. So I've learned to be patient.
Well, I understand that Fahrenheit 451 is actually, again, in production. They're going to do a remake. Can you tell us about that?
Mel Gibson bought the rights on that from me 8 years ago, too. And there are 16 scripts on Fahrenheit 451. And each one's worse. And you don't need 16 scripts. You know what you do? You shoot the novel. I knew Sam Peckinpah 20 years ago, and he wanted to do one of my novels as a film. I said, "Sam, how are you going to do it? He said, rip the pages out of the book and stuff them in the camera. I said, yes, I'm a film writer. I've seen every film ever made. My mother was a maniac for motion pictures. So she started taking me to movies in 1923 when I was three. I grew up in Lon Chaney and Charles Chaplin and all the really great people. And when I was five, I saw The Lost World with its dinosaurs, and it affected my life forever, huh? The whole rest of my life. So, and these people come up to me, and they have my properties, and they don't do anything with them. And Sam Peckinpah knew what to do, but he couldn't get the money.
How did you like the 1966, was it, Francois Truffaut version of Fahrenheit?
It's a beautiful film in many ways. The main problem comes, he did double casting. He had Julie Christie play two roles. Very confusing. Yeah. You can't tell the girl from the wife. And anyway, he left out the most important thing, the teenage girl who affects Montag's life. Huh? And it's got to be a teenager, though. See, the fun comes from a man who doesn't know books. He's burning them. But this teenage girl, Clarice McClellan, comes along. She's very naive. She's a romantic sap. She lives in the clouds, but she knows the weather of time. And she describes all this to Montag, and she wakes him up without knowing it. But if you don't have that in the film, all the fun is out. You don't want an intellectual woman teaching him about books. That's too easy. But it's got to be a sappy girl who's in love with life. So the film's got to be made over, and Clarice McClellan has got to be the center. I loved a lot of the other parts of the film, and the score by Bernard Herrmann is fantastic. And the ending of the film is one of the most beautiful endings on any film ever made, because you've got the beautiful score by Bernard Herrmann coming up during this fall of snow, and all the people, the book people, are out walking around in the snow remembering their favorite books. And it brings me to tears every time I see it. So that part of the film is gorgeous. So let's do the rest over and do it right this time.
What about The Sound of Thunder? That was one of the greatest stories ever.
I think the DVD of Sound of Thunder, all right, to show you how they handle it, try to find my name on here. My name's not on the goddamn DVD. How are you going to sell it? This story has been in 100 anthologies during the last 50 years. Every child in America has read the story. And when they made the film, they didn't put my name in the ads. They didn't put my name on the DVD. Now, how are you going to sell this to all those children that read me? That's how naive the studio people.
That is shocking. Yeah. I understand Gone with the Wind, they left Margaret Mitchell's name out of the whole Oscar ceremony.
That's right. That's right, yeah. They're all college educated. They think they know what they're doing. I've met all the people at Universal that are in charge of the Martian Chronicles. They all graduated from college. They all know more than I do, because I never made it to college, you see.
Yeah.
And so they're stupid in their brilliance.
Francis Coppola, he puts the name of the author above the title, like Mario Puzo's The Godfather.
Yeah.
On the plane coming down here, Mr. Bradbury, I was thumbing through Sam Weller's book, the Bradbury Chronicles. He looks like he was very thorough in his research.
Wonderful. He came out once a month, every month for 4 years. We had a platonic love affair. That's why the book is so good. He spent so much time here. Before he was born, his father read The Illustrated Man to him when he was in the womb. That's why the book is so good.
There's a quote I wanted to just run past because it made me laugh out loud on the airplane. He paints a picture of you having moved out here. You're a teenager. You're on roller skates ahead of your time, skating around Los Angeles, hanging out in front of the studios. And at one point, with your autograph book, you catch W.C. Fields coming out of the studio. He signs your book and says, "There you are, you son of a bitch."
That's right. He actually said that. Yes, he did. Yeah.
But he did sign it.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, I've got thousands of autographs. See that box down there?
Yes.
There's 500 autographs there of all the famous people in Hollywood when I was 13 years old.
And you actually had to chase Marlene Dietrich down at one point.
Oh, yeah. I'm the only autograph collector that ever made it over the wall and became a screenwriter. All those other people, nothing ever happened to them.
Well, can you tell us a little about that whole L.A. milieu? I guess you palled around. You convinced, as a teenager, you convinced George Burns to let you come and watch his rehearsals.
Yeah, I wrote scripts for the Burns and Al radio show. I was in junior high school. I was 13 years old. And every Wednesday I would go down to the Burns and Al broadcast, and I'd turn in a script for George Burns. And I'm sure he never read them, but he treated me kindly, and he introduced me to Gracie. And this went on for a whole year until I was 15. And they actually used one of my jokes on the Burns and Allen radio show when I was 15 years old. So 40 years later, I was at the Ambassador Hotel giving an award to Steven Spielberg at a luncheon. And I, in the middle of the award ceremony, I looked over in the corner and I saw George Burns over there. And I said, I stop everything. I got to tell you about this nice man that when I was a teenager treated me as if I were a genius. And George Burns read my scripts and treated me sweetly and nicely. And I said, I want to give him my own personal award today. Thank you, George. When the program was over, George Burns came running up to me and he said, "Was that you? Was that you? I remember you."
I'll be darned.
And we embraced for the first time in 40 years.
I'll be darned.
Yes, well.
He remembered you.
Oh, God, yeah.
Wow. Do you remember the joke that they used?
At the end of every show, they had a closing routine, which was 30 seconds long. And this little routine I wrote for them, Gracie makes noises like she's fainting, and George says, "Gracie, what's wrong? Oh my gosh, she's fainted. Get a glass of water. Gracie, say something. Oh, Gracie, say something." She says, "This is the Columbia Broadcasting System."
That was the end of the show.
And you're 15, and this goes out all over the nation. Your joke.
That's right.
Wow.
Well, back in the 1930s, I understand you were like 18 years of age, and you sort of fall into the Science Fiction Writers Club, headed by Forrest Ackerman. Can you tell us about Mr. Ackerman and the club?
Oh, God, yeah. I saw a notice at a bookstore in Hollywood, and I went down to a meeting. They met every Thursday night at the Clifton's Cafeteria, which is still down on Broadway, and the food is still damn good. And it cost me 10 cents for a meeting, and I didn't have money for food, and the Clifton's Cafeteria would give you a free meal if you asked for it, so I got a free meal every time I went there, and I met all the famous writers, and I was still in my last year in high school, and I met Robert Heinlein, and he became my friend and my teacher, and Edmund Hamilton and Lee Brackett, and they all became my friends and my teachers when I was 17, 18, and 19 years old. So I had a wonderful relationship, and that caused me to really become a better writer.
Well, have you pledged yet? We certainly hope so. But if you haven't, let's take a break in the narrative with Mr. Bradbury to give you a chance to do exactly that.
And you are listening to 90.1 KZFR. This is Radio Parallax on our pledge drive day. Thanks to Doug for reprising his interview with Ray Bradbury. I can remember reading Fahrenheit 451, The Martian Chronicles, Illustrated Man as a kid and loving those books. They were very influential in my life, that's for sure. I was a big science fiction fan, and I'm really glad that Doug has reprised this interview. Ray passed away in 2012, but man, his stories have remained just forever. And great radio has great stories to tell. The stories that you hear on KZFR help you connect with your community. And it's the stories that keep you listening in your car after you've come home. You're sitting in the driveway. You're still listening to the radio because it's compelling and you don't want to leave. 895-0131 is our phone number here to pledge your support for KZFR. And those stories are the stories that you go to our website for and listen to the archives. There's a lot of people working together here at KZFR to keep us afloat and vibrant and relevant, and to ensure that we continue to tell stories of people like you and me, people living here in our community. And people all over the world are listening to KZFR and making their contributions, too. Please join today by making a gift to KZFR. We rely on you to keep the local stories alive and well. 895-0131, online at kzfr.org. Let's get back to the show. This is Radio Parallax with Douglas Everett on 90.1 KZFR. Thank you.
Let's continue part two of our interview with Sci-Fi, although he disputes the fact that he's a science fiction writer. Let's call him fantasy writer Ray Bradbury.
Of all the other science fiction writers, what do you think would be the greatest science fiction story, in your opinion?
Recent ones or old ones?
Old ones, let's say.
Well, Jules Verne, of course, and H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells is a very important writer because he was paranoid. And teenage boys are paranoid, and they need to have a lunatic in charge.
And which story would you think is the greatest science fiction story of all time?
Oh.
Do you have a favorite?
Well, Invisible Man is one. And and then he did a wonderful story, The Man Who Could Work Miracles. But these are, in a way, fantasy, not science fiction. And right. He did a book called Things to Come, which made a science fiction film, which came out when I was 16, and caused me to continue with my love about space travel, because at the end of the film, Raymond Massey is playing a character, and this other guy stands with him, and their children, the son and the daughter, are going off in a moon rocket to the moon. And one of the men says, "Is this all there is?" And then Raymond Massey character says, "No, that is not all there is, that we have to choose the stars or the graveyard. Which shall it be, the stars or the dust?" And all the voices rise up and sing, "Which shall it be?" And I knew the answer when I staggered out of the theater. I was 16. It had to be the stars. And I hadn't sold my first short story yet, and I dug in and continued writing and sold my first story on my 21st birthday. And part of it was due to that film. It was a remarkable film.
You're a teenager. You're hanging out with this. In fact, you become the editor, I guess, from the magazine of the Science Fiction Club.
That's right, yes.
And at one point, a young man comes over from Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He's not that much older than you. His name's Jack Parsons, and he talks about how we're going to use rockets to go off into space.
Yes, we invited him to come down and talk to the group, and I think there were about 30 of us there that evening, and he told us about the Rocket Society, and we could join if we wanted to, but the problem was all the meetings were over in Pasadena, and I had no way of getting there. I had no money, and it cost a quarter a meeting to go there, and I had no quarter. It was the middle of the Depression,
right?
And my allowance was about a quarter a week, you see. So I had that one encounter with Parsons, but I knew that I was looking at the future.
In the years to follow, of course, over at Caltech, they'd formed Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and Aerojet becomes a commercial concern by the early 40s, so rocketry soon does get off the ground. And it's clear that science fiction was the inspiration for Parsons and others.
At least it helped. It put a prop under it. And you can't claim that you're a complete influence, but we all helped each other. And when you look back on Germany and von Braun in 1928-29, he looked at Fritz Lang's film, The Girl in the Moon, and that influenced him to invent the V-2 rocket. So we had a combination of good and evil here. When we landed on the moon, one of our first landings, and one of our first landings on Mars for the photographic equipment, that's 20 years ago, von Braun was standing next to me. And up until that time, I hadn't let myself be introduced to him because I considered his background with Hitler and the V2 rocket. And then I realized that was stupid of me. I'm making a judgment because history is full of good and evil, of men who begin evil and wind up changing mankind forever. So von Braun is responsible for getting us to the moon and to Mars. So I finally introduced myself, and he signed an envelope for me, which I still have downstairs, to Ray Bradbury, who influenced me. Ah! So, what a joke, huh? What a joke.
I understand that he arranged during World War II, von Braun, to have American science fiction writings sent to him in Sweden through a neutral country.
That's right, yes, yes.
Did you know Hugo Gernsback and John W. Campbell?
No, that was too soon. But he was important because he put out a magazine called Science and Invention from about 1914 till 1930. And it was a magazine that combined magic and sorcery with science and invention. And in the middle of the magazine was a whole page of magic by Denninger. And I used to rip those out, and I wanted to be a magician. So you see, I'm a combination, like Hugo Gernsback was, of turning magic into science. And that's the history of religion. All the early religions, with the Egyptians and the Greeks, they invented mysteries in the middle of the religions to impress people, to scare them, to have sepulchral voices telling people the future. So if you look through the history of magic, you see it changing into science and on the way up to space travel.
I guess Arthur C. Clarke is famous for saying that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
There's a lot of that. The magic had to come first because you enthrall yourself. You were affected by mysteries and by romance and by the stunning display of the universe and wanting to be part of it. So that pulls you into the future.
One thing that I find intriguing, it's not just people like Parsons and rockets, but I mean, Arthur C. Clarke wrote a paper. He was, of course, obviously a very famous science fiction writer. He wrote a paper in, I believe, 1945, predicting the geosynchronous orbit for communication satellites. Isaac Asimov, fantastic science fiction writer, made a career out of writing a lot of science books as well. So it seems to be that science fiction is sometimes leading and science is catching up.
They were all scientists. And I'm a fantasist. I never wrote science fiction. I've only done one science fiction book, and that's Fahrenheit 451, because it's based on fact that could happen. But my Mars is impossible. It's a fantasy. It's in Edgar Rice Burroughs' world. And he influenced me when I was 10, 11, 12 years old. And my first novel written when I was 12 is a duplicate of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars.
Do you have friendships with both Mr. Clarke and Asimov?
I didn't know Asimov that well, but Arthur Clarke and I have been good friends for 50 years, even though I'm not a scientist.
And you said that Heinlein influenced you quite a bit. He sort of took you under his wing, did he?
Yeah, he read something of mine, and he said, hell, I can sell this for you. And he sent it off to Script Magazine, and he made my first sale for me.
Wow.
So God bless him. I was 18 years old then. So Heinlein sold my first story.
Which story was that?
It was a humorous story, that a piece of satire, that there used to be a magazine here called Script. It was like the New Yorker. And by God, they bought my story, and I was on my way. When I left high school, I got a job selling newspapers every afternoon at 4 o'clock for 2 hours. Before I went to the corner each day, I wrote all day, and in the evening I went to the library. So when I left high school, I went to the library 2 or 3 days a week for 10 years. I graduated from the library when I was 28. And when I told people up the coast, I was lecturing at a university there a few years ago, at the end of my lecture, he came back with my diploma and graduated me from the library. Isn't that great?
That's cute. You've been friends for a long time with Norman Corwin, who lives not so far from here. We were privileged to speak with Mr. Corwin a couple months ago, and after we leave here, we're going to go visit him again. Okay. Tell us about your good friend, Mr. Corwin.
Now, he became my closest friend and teacher. When I was 26 years old, my first book was published, and I listened to Corwin's shows on radio over the years and was madly in love with his talent. So I got his address and wrote him a letter and sent him a copy of my first book. And I said, "Dear Mr. Corwin, if you like this book half as much as I love you and your shows, please call me. I want to buy you drinks someday." A week later, he called me. He said, "You're not buying me drinks. I'm buying you dinner." So I went to dinner with him that week. That's 60 years ago. And at dinner, I told him one of my Martian stories. And he said, "Oh, God, that's great. Do more of those." So I did more. And Norman Corwin was God to me. And he created the Martian Chronicle.
I'll be darned.
That's how important he is to me.
You did some radio dramas back in the 50s. We're big radio fans. Do you think there's a future for some drama in radio again with satellites and the like?
It comes and goes. And it's still alive in England. It's not doing as well here. They do a lot of repetitions of old shows. But I'd love to have my own radio show again and be able to do what I did on Columbia Broadcasting System and NBC 50 years ago.
One of the great characters in science fiction who plays a prominent role in this whole story about Parsons and rocketry and science fiction is L. Ron Hubbard. Did you know Hubbard at all?
No, I didn't, but I've got a story to tell you about him. Dianetics and Scientology were born here in L.A. A lot of people here taught Dianetics, as it was called, and L. Ron Hubbard came and went. And I never met him, but I knew a lot of people who believed in him. So there was a big meeting of Dianetic readers at the Shrine Auditorium in the fall of 1950. And at that time, Fritz Lang, the great German director, was a friend of mine. And he went to that meeting because L. Ron Hubbard was speaking, and they were introducing Dianetics to the public. There were 7,000 people at the Shrine Auditorium that evening, and Fritz came back to my house at midnight in a rage. The veins were popping on his brow. He was beet red. He was screaming and yelling, and that was Fritz. Fritz was an angry man, and he stormed into my house. He said, "Those stupid goddamn bastards, they didn't know what they're doing." I said, "What happened, Fritz?" He said, "I went to the Shrine Auditorium. They announced that L. Ron Hubbard would be there, and on the program was going to be the first clear in history." Well, if people don't know what a clear is, then if you read your genetics and really know it, you become a clear. You clear your mind of all of his problems and psychological barriers, and you are a clear. So he said they had this girl on the stage. She was introduced as the first clear in history because of L. Ron Hubbard, and the audience goes wild, applauding. And then someone in the audience stands up and said, "Miss, you're a clear, are you?" "Yeah." "And that means that you have read Dianetics?" "Yeah." "And that means if you're a clear, you have the most perfect memory in history?" "Right." "Well, can you quote the first paragraph of Dianetics?" And she couldn't do it. The damn fools should have had a shield in the audience to prepare, huh? And here Fritz was in my house tearing his hair out, saying, "If I'd prepared the evening, it would have been brighter than those stupid bastards." So Dianetics almost was destroyed that night because they didn't prepare. But it went on and became Scientology, and now it's all over the world.
I'd heard that night was a fiasco. This is the first second-hand report I've gotten.
That's right.
It surprised me in doing research, Mr. Bradbury, that you wrote the screenplay for Moby Dick. How did that come about?
I gave all of my books to John Huston one night in January or February of 1959 on St. Valentine's Night, a night to start a romance with your favorite director. And I put all my books out on the table. I said, Mr. Huston, if you like these books half as much as I love your films, someday call me. So he wrote me from Africa and said, you're right. Someday we're going to work together. I don't know on what. He came back to L.A. in August of 1953 and invited me up for drinks at his hotel, and all of a sudden said to me, what are you doing during the next year? I said, not much. He said, well, how'd you like to come live in Ireland and write the screenplay of Moby Dick? I was stunned. I was stunned. I said, I don't know, Mr. Huston. I've never been able to read that damn book. And he couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that I was saying that. And he said, I tell you what, go home tonight and read as much as you can and come back tomorrow and tell me if you'll help me kill the white whale. So I went home and I said to my wife, pray for me. And she said, why? I said, because I've got to read a book tonight and do a book report tomorrow. And I read as much as I could, and I discovered a remarkable thing that I didn't know, that Shakespeare was all through the book. Richard III and King Lear and what have you. And the fact was that Melville never read Shakespeare till he was 30, and then he found an edition of Shakespeare with large type that he could read. And he fell madly in love with Shakespeare, and Shakespeare dictated Moby Dick.
I'll be
so
done.
I could read the whole book, but I could surf it, and I could surf Shakespeare. And I went back the next day and took the job of writing Moby Dick.
Fascinating. You received an awful lot of honors over the years, Mr. Bradbury. There's an asteroid that's named after you out orbiting somewhere near the orbit of Mars. You've been honored by the President of the United States. What has been the most gratifying for you over the years in terms of recognition?
No, just going into a library and seeing my books on the shelf near Edgar Rice Burroughs and H.G. Wells and Jules Verne. That is the moment for me. Wonderful. Just wonderful. I've led a fantastic life. I've never had an unhappy day in my life. In the last 70 years, I've never had one day of depression or melancholy. You know why? Because every day I do something that I love. I've had bad days when my friends die, when my relatives die. That's different. Something else. You can't do anything about that. But every day that I'm all by myself, I'm happy, because I'm doing what I should be doing. If everyone in the world could do that, it would be a great world.
Ray Bradbury, we thank you very much for speaking with us. This has been most interesting for us. We hope that we'll be able to chat again sometime.
I hope so. And in the meantime, next time you see Norman Corwin, tell him I still love him.
All right. Ray Bradbury received an Emmy for his work on The Halloween Tree. He's also received the World Fantasy Award Life Achievement, the Stoker Award Life Achievement, and on November 17, 2004, Ray Bradbury was the recipient of the National Medal of Arts presented by President Bush. All right, we certainly hope you have pledged by now, but if you hadn't, we're going to take a break from our narrative, go back to live in studio, and give you a chance to hear a few more reasons why it is you should contribute to KZFR.
What a great interview with author Ray Bradbury. He's not a science fiction writer. He's a fantasy writer. You heard about that. Truly an American icon. Absolutely passed away in 2012. And I'm glad Doug has played that for us. Thanks for doing it. And KZFR is a non-commercial community radio station that needs your support. 895-0131 is our phone number. There's no advertising paying for this program that you're listening to. We survive on donations from the public like you. We're truly listener supported, and that's where you come in, because we operate on a budget that's just a fraction of what non-commercial radio stations have in this town. 75% of our funding comes from listeners that like Radio Parallax and our music shows. That's 3 out of every 4 songs you hear on KZFR. 45 minutes out of every hour is paid for by donations from people like you. That's okay, because we believe that the unique mix of music and news that we provide is worth supporting, and we know that you understand that. Right now, we're asking you to support this eclectic mix of programs and shows just like Radio Parallax you can't find anywhere else on the radio. It is important, and make that call, 895-0131. Stand up for something different. Stand up and support radio that's engaging, that takes chances, and that's here for you every time you tune in. And remember, your support for KZFR is what keeps this station on the air. Call us now at 895-0131. You can contribute online at kzfr.org. Be the next one to call. Make it be you, 895-0131. And let's fill out the rest of the hour with Jackie Green, recorded live at the Chico Women's Club just last year when Merle Haggard passed away. He's playing the Steinway piano. Enjoy Jackie Green from the KZFR archives on 90.1 KZFR Chico.
All right, how are you guys doing? So we have a little bit of a change in the program. As you guys probably are aware, we lost a great, great artist today, Merle Haggard, who's a hero of all of ours. So we're going to do this first set for Merle. It's a big job just getting by with 9 kids and a wife. I've been a working man down here all my life. I keep on working, long as my hands are fit to use. Well, I'll drink a little beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working man blues. Keep my nose to the grindstone, I work hard every day. Come back home on the weekend, after I draw my pay, I'll be back working. Monday morning, right back with the crew. Well, I'll drink a little beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working man blues. Well, hail, hail the working man, that's me. I won't be in no welfare line. There's one place I will be. I'll be back working. Gotta buy my kids a brand new pair of shoes. Well, I'll drink a little beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working man blues. I'll work a while. Train to another town, but I'll be back working. long enough to hand the fit to use. Well, I drink a little beer in the tavern, sing a little bit of these working man blues. Well, I might drink a little beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working man blues. This dirty old city, and tired, too much work, and never enough play. I'm tired of this dirty old sidewalk. I think I'll walk off my steady job today. Set me free somewhere in the middle of Montana. Give me all I've got, come into me and keep your retirement and your so-called social security. City, turn me loose and set me free. I was 20. I haven't got a thing to show for anything I've done. Some folks, they never work and they've got plenty. I think it's time some guys like me had some fun. Turn me, set me free somewhere in the middle of Montana. Give me all I've got, come into me and keep your retirement and your so-called social security. Big city, turn me loose and set me free. Big city, turn me loose and set me free.
Thank you. And let you go. But each time I bend my way to you somehow, if I left it up to you, it'd all be over now. It'd all be over now. except the crying. I'd be used to spending all my nights alone. Wish I'd found a way to let you go somehow. If I'd left it up to you, it'd all be over now. It'd all be over now, except the crying. I'd be used to spending all my nights alone. Wish I'd found a way to let you go somehow. If I'd left it up to you, it'd all be over now. If I'd left it up to you, it'd all be over
now. If you like this, Jackie Green, you're listening to on 90.1 KZFR. Call us. Pledge drive going on right now, 895-0131. Thank you.
You guys all right? You okay? Thank you for indulging us. This is a... Hag wasn't just any old artist, so... over, not feeling any pain, you're closing time, but tonight your memory found me much too sober, couldn't drink enough to keep you off my mind. Let me down and let your memory come around. The one true friend I thought I'd found. Tonight the bottle let me down.
One true friend I thought I'd found.
Jelly time.
peanut butter jelly time. Way at